birthday party?
Miracle. There you go.
Welcome to the Abracadam Podcast. I'm your host, stand-up comedy magician Danny Whitson. And like always, Abracadamits, I hope you're getting stuff done, son. If you got those goals, I hope you're trying to achieve them. I definitely got started on mine this past week. I started working out for the first time in quite a while. And I gotta say, my ass muscles hurt. Yeah. I did some squats and now I can barely move, but I do know it's a start, and I do know after a few hundred more of these, I probably won't be as sore. So, but definitely a great start for me, great start. And I hope whatever you're looking to do, you got started as well. If you're traveling anywhere through the Southeast right now, be careful because it's a snowstorm. There's snow dumping everywhere, as you probably know right now. Well, that is, unless you are in the Tennessee Valley, we are not getting nothing here, but just cold rain. So yeah, we literally got 1 to 2 inches of muddy leaves and cold rain while everyone else got snow. But anyways, if you are out there traveling, definitely please be careful. Before we get started, I want to give, some show dates real quick. February 1st, me and the very funny Shelly Belly, we're going to be at a stand-up live comedy club in Huntsville, Alabama. That's February 1st. And then February 2nd, we'll be moving on down to the Stardome Comedy Club in Birmingham, Alabama. And then February 3rd, we'll be wrapping it up at Zany's Comedy Club in Nashville, Tennessee. So if you're interested in coming to any of those shows, you can go to the website at Zany's, Stardome, or Stand Up Live and purchase your tickets there. Definitely, I would love to see you guys come out and see a show. All right. Well, before we get going, also, let's give a quick shout out to the sponsors for the Abracadam Podcast. Okay. Well, today's episode is brought to you by Rosie Tattoos. Custom tattoos designed to suit your style in a friendly and clean environment. I've been getting my tattoos done by Rosie for a while now, and I couldn't recommend anyone else because she does excellent work. As a matter of fact, I got an appointment to see Rosie here in just a few weeks, and I cannot wait to get my ink therapy done, baby. Rosie gets free consultations by Facebook Messenger, Instagram, or by email. Shoot her an email at rosietattoos@yahoo.com. Give Rosie a call today at 865-281-3451 or go see Rosie at 5710 Kingston Pike, Knoxville, Tennessee. Get your ink therapy done. You know you want a tattoo. Go see Rosie Tattoos. All right, Abracadamits. Now, today's guest is he's a fantastic magician. He's got a lot of things going on, but probably one of the most exciting things is he will be representing North America at FISM. And for you guys not familiar with FISM, it's like the Magic Olympics. So very, very exciting. So if you will, sit back and relax and enjoy my conversation with comedian and magician Eric Tate. All right, we got magician Eric Tate here today on the Abracadam Podcast. How you doing, Eric?
I'm doing well, Danny. How are you?
Doing good, man. I tell you what, if you don't mind, will you go ahead and introduce yourself to the Abracadam listeners?
Sure. My name is Eric Tate. I'm a magician and comedian based in Columbus, Ohio. A lot of magicians know me because I am the host of the Penguin Magic podcast, and I'm one of the on-camera talents for Penguin Magic, the world's largest magic retailer. I am also, I've been appeared on Penn and Teller Fool Us. I worked on the show Ships of the Northern Fleet. I've been in the New York Times, and I think the thing most people know me for these days is in 2022. Actually, now we're in 2022. I'll be representing the continent of North America at FISM, which is the World Championships of Magic.
That is awesome. By the way, I did not know you were going to FISM, so congratulations, brother. That is amazing.
Thank you. Thank you.
Super cool, man. Super, super cool. Well, let's do this real quick because I mean, yeah, you've got a lot of things, you're involved in a lot of things. Now in, you know, as a magician, literally we're always asked this question. I don't know if you ever heard Matt King's answer to this. I think he has the best answer to this of all freaking time, but, What got you into magic, brother?
I was tricked into it, to be honest with you. I mean, and I know that a lot of people say that facetiously, but I quite literally was. I started off as a juggler, and I got a job in, so I know you're from Knoxville, and I grew up in Knoxville. I went to Farragut High School. I was on their improv team. And when it was like my senior year in high school, I got a job at a place called the Comedy Barn in Pigeon Forge, Tennessee. Up until very recently, I was still in their brochures. They like to reuse art around there. But I was a juggler in their show. And if you ever go to the show, the way it used to open anyway, at least before Dollywood bought them, the show would start out, the curtain would come up and this band would start, you know, singing, "Hail, hail, the gang's all here at the funniest show in town, the Comedy Barn." And then two tall, gangly looking dudes would run out, jump over a bench, and then juggle clubs and then fire for about a minute and a half. And that was literally my job in the show, to do that. So I would like run out, I would juggle for a minute and a half, and then I would go sit backstage. And the cast members of the Comedy Barn all worked the souvenir booths outside of the show in the lobby. So that some of us were in the concession stands, others were in the souvenir booths. And the owner of the place came up to me and went, "You're a juggler, you probably know magic. Go work in our magic booth." And so I had like done magic as a kid. Like I've done, you know, cups and balls was arguably the first trick that I ever had. My dad got it for me when we were at a magic shop in Atlanta, Georgia. I went back to that shop recently and it's a Starbucks now. And I had magic kits and Svengali decks, but I wasn't like a serious magician. So when I got behind that booth, there was a ventriloquist there named Stephen Knowles, who I believe is still in Pigeon Forge. And Stephen taught me my first couple of card sleights and how to pitch a Svengali deck, mental photography, which I still love the mental photography deck. I should get one of those today. I haven't done it in a while. And that was kind of it. I fell in love with cards, and I've held a deck of cards in my hands pretty much every day since. That was kind of it.
That's interesting too, that you started as a juggler. And first of all, the Comedy Barn, great place, guys, if you're listening, to catch a family comedy show. So you started out juggling, you started out, and then it was the magic bug that came later, right? It wasn't like a magic kit or anything like that.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, like I'd had magic kits as a kid, but it wasn't something that I really focused on. I mean, like I got exposed to magic. Like I got seriously exposed to magic by being a magic pitch shop guy. I ended up working, you know, while I was working at the Comedy Barn, I got a part-time job at Precision Magic in Pigeon Forge, which is David Mann's shop. And so, I became a professional magician the same day I became a pitch shop magician, and which is the same day I got sort of interested in magic. It was like all at the same time. And so I got like, I just sort of like had a fire hose of magic open to me at that point. It very quickly grew from there. I mean, I remember going home from work and being like, "Oh, this is kind of interesting. I wonder if there's any other like trick," like, you know, I wanted to do better because, you know, at the time, our sales were directly related to a bonus that we got. And so I remember going home and like the early days of the internet, I'm like looking up, you know, tricks you can do with the Svengali deck. Cause we were just like a pitch shop. We just had like, I think we had 8 items that I would like string together a show out of. And so I was like looking for different routines and like how to like make it more impossible. Cause I sort of, I understood that if you could make it impossible, but in a way that you could be like, "Hey, you can do this," then it would be more appealing for someone to want to buy that stuff. And to make it appealing to a kid, because you almost never sold a trick to an adult in a place like that. It was different at the magic shop that I was working in. Cause you could sell magic to a person. You could be like, "Hey, this is really cool. You can get this book or this thing." You could do some different things, but like when you're in a souvenir booth, like pitch stand scenario, you want to like get the kids to be like, "Dad, I want that." And then you have to like, you have to sell it in a way that like the kid can do it, but really you're selling the adult on that the adult can do it. That was actually how I was exposed to Penguin Magic, the company I work for now. I mean, like 20 years ago, my my first, like, I bought, I remember the first trick I bought from Penguin was $2 window, which was actually a download by Jay Noblezada that I recently refilmed. I've been doing that trick since I was a senior in high school. and now I'm the, now I'm reteaching that trick that I originally bought. So it's, I mean, it's been a really wild journey to get to where I am, but yeah, like that's kind of it. It was
What's cool is though, is like you, you've picked up a variety of skills, you know, I mean, and cause I mean, sales pitching, that's a whole new ball game. That's a whole new thing on its own, you know? And
I mean, I think I was suited to it because, the job that I had all through high school for like 3 years, 4 years, I think, until I got into the Comedy Barn, maybe it was 3 years, was, I worked at a pet shop in Knoxville, Tennessee called Fins and Skins.
Yes. I've only, heard of
that. Yeah. So they're closed now, but I used to work for a guy named Mike Herrick and we only sold tropical fish and exotic reptiles. And so my after school job was to go to work and convince parents that yes, their child should own a snake. So it was, I mean, you know, you wanted to like sell to the right people so that you knew the animal was going to go have a good life. But like, you know, I had been doing, I've never worked in a restaurant. I have no idea what the service industry is like. I've always been in some sort of like sales application.
You know, and you mentioned how you were juggling. This is something that's always interesting because, I mean, of course, being magicians, we know jugglers. And
there's no better gig in the world than being the juggler at a magic convention. Man, I was just at a convention here in Columbus. And one of the headliners was Passing Zone, which were, they got huge on AGT, but they destroyed. They just absolutely, I mean, there's a room full of magicians who are just like, it's a bunch of people who can sort of like stand back and understand like kind of how difficult things are, but because they're not jugglers, they don't understand like what the tough parts are. So me being a juggler in the back, I'm clapping at all the wrong moments because I know what like the tough stuff is that the juggler is doing to make themselves happy and not to make the audience happy.
Well, you know, though, that's one of the weird things about magic is I bring this up all the time too, is like, unlike juggling or all the other performing arts, like if someone gets up and sings, you're like, wow, that person is very, you know, talented with their voice. And even with juggling, you're like, wow, that takes physical skill. Mm-hmm. One of the messed up things about magic is we practice and practice and practice and practice for it to look like we're not doing anything absolutely at all.
I know where you're going with this, and I don't think that's, I hate to cut you off, but you finish your statement and then I'll respond. Because I think what you're about to say is not true.
Well, I mean, what I'm saying is, Well, let's just, you know, for example, let's take something like a really badass card control. Mm-hmm. Okay. You want it to look like nothing has happened. They've placed the card in the deck and absolutely nothing has happened, but something has happened. And let's say, for example, it's a very difficult move to master. Only magicians can appreciate that, you know, at all. Unlike the, you know, mass public can watch a juggler and be like, well, the guy's juggling chainsaws. That's impressive. That's one of the things about magic that is, it's odd. It's one of the odd things about what we do.
I think that this is a fallacy that is perpetuated by magicians. So like, let's take the juggling chainsaws, for example. So a lot of people don't realize this, but in some ways juggling chainsaws is actually easier than juggling normal clubs, because at least with the version where you're juggling mini chainsaws, where they've got like a handle on it, the chainsaw actually helps bring itself around. So like, you're thinking like, oh, you have to have a great deal of strength to like get that to spin. It's actually not really like it wants to spin. So there's an example of something that looks a lot more difficult than it actually is, because juggling a chainsaw is actually no different than juggling a club. The hard part is, it's the same with knives and fire. People are like, oh, this is dangerous. It's actually not. It's, you know, juggling fire is no more or less dangerous than juggling a club or a knife. You know, maybe a knife is a little more dangerous if you throw it way up in the air and then it comes down point first on your head, but like, just the basic act of juggling is not terribly dangerous with these objects. In magic, I think that a lot of magicians sort of cling to this idea of naturalness because, and I know your audience is not super magic centric, yeah. which you told me off pod, but there's a, for the non-magicians in the room, there's a gentleman by the name of Di Vernon, who we consider the father of modern close-up magic. Now he's an older guy. He's dead now. But he always talked about naturalness because he read it in this book called Expert at the Card Table, which was ostensibly a book about how to cheat at cards. And the author said that, you know, a card cheat has to be natural. And that may be true in the context of you know, doing sleight of hand at a poker table. A magician doesn't actually have to be natural. A magician has to be convincing and entertaining and sell you the fiction that what we are going to do is defy the laws of reality. But it's different now than it was. So, you know, Kevin James was on America's Got Talent, and he has this trick where he saws somebody in half, and then, you know, the top half of the person gets up and runs around. And I'm not going to tell you the method to that. It's not terribly, you know, anyone who watches it for more than 10 minutes can sort of like have an idea where this is going, because the magic is actually in the restoring it. But Kevin James is not the originator of that trick. That trick actually was originally done in the late 1800s, maybe early 1900s. And I can't remember the name of the magician, but I know Kevin has talked about this elsewhere. But the first time that version of the trick is done, where the person is sawn in half and then the top half gets up and like moves themselves around with their arms, was done almost 100 years ago. And people freaked out. It caused a riot. Like, the magician couldn't finish the trick. I mean, the original version of sawing in half, people freaked out and it caused a riot. They were like, oh, because there was no unspoken agreement between the audience and the magician that what we're about to do is not real, but if we all just play along, it's going to be fine. Magic's in a different place these days, where, you know, there are people on Instagram and TikTok and Facebook doing magic tricks. Now, regard whatever you think about these magicians, or, you know, let's set aside the debate as to whether or not that is or is not magic. You know, magicians have won AGT like more than other skill sets combined, right? Penn and Teller Fool Us is in its eighth season now. I think they're casting for their eighth season. Like, the general public is aware of magic. You have to go pretty far and pretty deep to find someone who is not aware of magic as either an art form or that it is a form of entertainment. You know, that's not to say that there aren't areas, because I know people will like come up and be like, well, what about David Blaine's special where he went to, that's a different thing, right? He's doing a different thing in like a different area where the people understand magic both as entertainment and as a culture. You know, we can set aside the Indian fakir and things like that. By and large, everyone knows what it is. And so there is an unspoken agreement between the magician and the lay audience that what I am doing is a skillful act. And I genuinely think that. I mean, I go out of my way in my close-up show to tell people this stuff is hard. What you are looking at is because my internal monologue as I'm performing is not look at these wondrous things. It is what I am doing is a demonstration of skill for which you have no explanation, which is a fine distinction from magic. I mean, I almost wouldn't even consider my close-up show magic. It's just literally me showing off. It's juggling with a deck of cards. And I think that more or less is why I have been successful with the lay public. I'm not real famous by any means. I do have lay people who will go to my shows and will travel to see my shows. But when I perform for these people, you know, people understand how difficult it is. And I tell them that. And I think that there's other magicians who do that as well. I mean, Jason LaDany does the same thing. I mean, he just straight up tells people like, it's all card cheating stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Very Darwin.
And yeah. I mean, like Darwin Ortiz like did a lot of that stuff. And I think there's more and more magicians who are doing that. I kind of think you're doing a disservice to the audience if you try and stay in this whole, like, you know, don't, you know, it's all real. Like, don't break the illusion. Like, you know, like no one goes to a play and thinks to themselves that person died on stage.
Yeah. Like, well, yeah.
I mean, it's, and I think magic is the same way. And so I think that there is a to sort of get back to what you were saying, I think there is a belief among magicians that you have to be natural in order for people to see it and to hide your skill. And frankly, that's bullshit. I think that your audience is intelligent enough to understand what you're doing. That's not to say do things badly or anything like that. It's just that like they get it and they're cool. And if you're not cool with them, like you're basically telling them they're stupid. And I think modern audiences are not stupid. I think when you approach magic with all of this knowledge in mind, I think the audience has a deeper appreciation for both the mystery that you're presenting and the skill that you are demonstrating.
And you know what, Eric? Okay, let me clarify a little bit. I'm on board with what you're saying. Absolutely, 100%. I'm on board with what you're saying. I think maybe on the probably what I was talking about was maybe a little more closely to related to what you were talking about. Like it's perceived differently with juggling, that chainsaws are actually really not harder to juggle.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about some of the things that laymen do not know and will not know, that they will go unappreciated, only appreciated by magicians. Now, granted, they will say, well, it does take skill to do these things. Of course, I have people come up to me after my shows and, you know, and they do have that general interest in magic, and they want to talk to you because they respect magic, because they, you know, they may have tried something at one time and realized how much, you know, time and effort and practice we do have to put into these things. But let's do this, because you kind of compared times. There is a time differential now.
I think let me just like quickly address. I think that is what you're talking about, where they like there are some people who just can't appreciate it because they look at it at a very surface level, and other people who like can because they're like looking at it a little bit deeper. That's true of any art form and any sort of endeavor in the human experience. Dance, singing, you know, I mean, like some people are like, oh, well, you know, because you get people who will listen to pulling a name out of my hat here. Some people listening to Lady Gaga and will say, oh, she must have trained for years to have that voice. And other people will just say, oh, well, she's just naturally gifted, right? I mean, like, they're both right.
Yeah.
I think that everyone in any art form who has applied themselves to it a lot has this sort of like, you know, no one really understands me. No one understands all of the sacrifice that I had. And it's just like, okay, you're cool. Is that really what you want me to tell you? Like,
yeah.
I mean, I see a lot of magicians in private forums, like talking about this stuff. And it's just like, I really hate to put it this way, but I'm just like, get over yourself a little bit, because you, everything that you are talking about right now, where people, and not you, like sort of the metaphorical you, but everything that somebody is talking about with is like, oh, you know, people don't understand like how hard magic is or anything like that. Like, like dancers go through the same thing, you know, yeah. Musicians go through the same thing. And to sort of extend the conversation further, like everyone who's like, oh, I see these comments in private forums all the time. We're like, you know, people don't understand that I'm not a birthday magician or something like that. Well, it's probably because you presented yourself in some sort of stereotypical way, because no one comes up to me after my show and says, hey, my kid's birthday is next week. Would you like to do it? You know, I get occasionally people emailing me because people don't like understand that, like a magician may not do a kid's birthday party, but for, you know, artists get people, you know, I was just literally like reading a BuzzFeed listicle last night of all the times that people had reached out to artists and be like, why can't you just draw me the picture for free? Why does it cost $300? I just want a line drawing. And people are having to like break down like art school and, you know, rent and materials and time and things like that. And I think there was a time when magic was like very stereotypical, like, you know, kid's birthday party dude, but it's just not that way anymore. And I think at some level, people are just like looking to be put upon a little bit. I think,
you know what though, also, and to make it even a more broader topic, that's human nature with every job, everything they do. I agree with you 100%. Also, I got to stay the hell out of those magic forums, dude. I can't handle them. I can, cause everyone's an expert and it's the one whole opinion.
Yeah.
Now this is interesting though, Eric, because if you look back at the way before the internet and before these things, people would people would go their whole lives to never see a magic trick ever or a magician ever. And whenever, you know, audiences would witness a magic show, they were, there was a moment where they were trying to figure this, is this real? Is this not? What is happening? And because of this day and age, magic is absolutely everywhere, everywhere. Mm-hmm. It's easy to find. It's in our faces. America's Got Talent, fool us. In some ways, this is fantastic, but, and I'm not even saying this is a bad thing, but it's going in a new direction where magic has really never been before. This is what's interesting to me, and I wonder about this, because magic, regardless to what you say, regardless to what anybody wants to say, magic secrecy kind of is a big deal. A little bit. And now this is the thing. Hold on. I'm not somebody obsessed with secrets. You can come up to me and be like, hey, yeah, I don't care. I want to entertain you. But if something, our art form is designed to where you have to go, it's not common knowledge. Let me put it that way. how do you think the future of magic will be now that we are in the information age to where privacy is absolutely non-existent?
It's fine. It's going to be fine. It's never the dirty secret in magic is that you can learn how any trick works for about $50. I've talked about this before on a few other podcasts, and because that question always comes up from magicians. But what's interesting is the question always comes up from magicians interviewing other magicians in podcasts, but it never comes up when I'm interviewed by a magazine or a newspaper or like a sort of standard fair journalist. They never ask them. Magicians are very concerned about it. The quote from Jim Steinmeier always comes to mind: "Magician's garden, empty safe." But the good
great
stuff.
Quote. Great quote.
Yeah, it's a great quote, but it's like, it's not even that we guard an empty safe. It's that like we tell people there's a safe, but it's not there at all. I mean, that's the truth of the matter. You can buy the act that Shin Lim won America's Got Talent with. Like, if you really want to learn how it works, I mean, and it's not even that expensive. It's $200. it's really not that expensive. If you want to know how certain illusions work, you can literally search the patent. There's like, people have patented illusions, right? Which is, so like, when you patent something, you have to provide detailed schematics as to like how it works. So that, like, that is on, like, you can Google how certain very famous illusions work, and it comes up in a US government archive. It's out there. If you want proof that the magic is going to be fine regardless of the information age, just go look at any single working performer who is even remotely successful on a cruise ship or a corporate level. The stuff they're doing is not, like, in general, is not groundbreaking. It's the same kind of stuff that people have been doing for years. It all comes down to the fact that they're extraordinarily entertaining and interesting people to watch and listen to. I vividly remember being on a cruise ship a number of years ago and watching the magic act and thinking to myself, well, none of this is cool. I know all of this. And I had to sort of like be humbled by the fact that, like, yeah, I may be able to do some like really killer card sleights, and I may be, you know, I can do some sleight of hand that only a handful of people in the world can do, but that guy's working because people want to pay attention to him. And that, I mean, like, that was like a fundamental shift in the way I approached my act.
That's everything, man. That's,
yeah,
everything.
I mean, like, go back and look at like, go back and look at the old like Magic Week videos that Letterman used to do. You know, Lance Burton does Silk to Egg on that show.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Silk to Egg is 150 years old. It's, you know, I mean, you can find it in a library book. That stuff has always been there. I think what sucks is the piracy that is going on. You know, there's
That's exactly where I was about to go. I was about to go with there because that's another problem. And I mean, with the information age, I think, you know, the information for magic has always been there. I mean, but before, I'm sure magicians freaked out whenever magic books became a popular thing and magic DVDs and stuff became a popular thing. It's like anything else. If you really want to learn, you can go find these things and you can learn them. But now here's kind of where I was wanting to lead into, which you brought up the piracy is, do you think because of piracy, magicians may withhold some things, and the only way to actually learn the true good stuff will resort back maybe to a mentor, like a one-on-one or something like that. What do you think is going to happen out of this?
No, I don't. I honestly don't. I mean, now I'm not speaking on behalf of the company I work for at this point. But the reason piracy sucks is because it just drives up the prices for other people, and it makes it more difficult for good stuff to come out, and you just experience like higher turnover rate in both like creators and like the people who work in the industry. It's like incredibly disheartening when I work for months on a product that I really believe in, and I like, you know, I worked with the artist to like make it great. I worked with the artist to like go out and get great performances. I worked with the artist to like, maybe they've never taught on video before, and I got to coach them through the whole process of teaching through video. And then, you know, just because of the nature of the industry that we work in, it's not a big company. Like it's, you know, there's only like, you know, five of us who edit the videos. So like, I also end up like having a pretty big hand in editing these things. So I work for months on projects, you know, getting everything shot correctly, edited correctly, and sounding great. And then like looking cool and making you like excited, you know, because we do have that, you know, I have the additional sales problem of, I can't tell you exactly why this thing is so cool because I am selling you a secret. You know, I may be also selling you a toy, for lack of a better explanation, because there's like a special prop or a gimmick that I also sell you. But I can't tell you exactly what it is most of the time, because that's just like the way magic works, right? Like you'd be pissed if I, you know, broadcast the secret everywhere. It's like, it's a really weird sales problem when you think about it. You know, but when I work for months on this stuff and then someone buys it on our site and then turns around and sells it, you know, sells it on their own site for a dollar. And it's just like, that is like that, you know, if you're really going to do that, like, why are you discounting it? Like, you're discounting it so cheap to like undercut me so people will buy from you instead of me, you know, but also like, is that really what you value like this at? Like, cause I think that this secret is really interesting and really valuable. And that's why it's like pricing like this. There's all kinds of stuff that goes into that. But also like, I got these, you know, I got a camera guy that we pay, and you know, editors and lighting and infrastructure, and cameras aren't cheap. And we, you know, we got lenses, and then, you know, I don't know if anyone is involved in creative software, but there's a monthly subscription fee to be able to have the software to be able to edit this stuff, you know, and then you got to like, you know, work with people to get it, like, you know, the photos done and the artwork done and, you know, the ad copy written and everything like that. And then just like to see that, like, you know, turn around and like sold for a dollar, and then people like going out and buy it just so that they can learn the secret, not even so they can perform it. Like, it'd be one thing if you were buying it and then going out doing it, because like then I would think like, oh, but if you're just like collecting a secret for a buck, and it's just like, that's like, that's really disrespectful. But it's not like, I think in the short term that there are probably one or two things that people are holding back for themselves and not selling because they don't want to, like, you know, they're looking at it not even from like you're just giving away my secrets. They're looking at it purely from a business perspective. They're like, oh, I'm going to wait until I can sell this and, like, you know, get better profit margin on it. Like, that just makes sense. But the industry will figure it out. I mean, it's, you know, the same thing happened with music. The same thing happened with movies. The same thing happened with television. the industry just like figures it out. I think the thing that people don't understand, and I had a really, I was at a magic convention and there was a very prominent magician from a competitor of ours who said something really interesting that stuck with me, is that the people who are perpetuating this piracy, who are actually like engaging in it, who are stealing the products and then putting it up on their site for really cheap. Not only do they disrespect me as the creator and producer of the product, they don't give two rips about you as the customer. And these people are taking credit card information. And if you think they care very little about the art and the product that I spent time to produce, do you think they care at all about your personal banking information? Because they're just making another buck on that, selling that to thieves and pirates who are going to steal your identity. I mean, it's just like you're only hurting yourself and putting yourself at risk when you buy pirated stuff. I mean, I get that magicians share secrets with each other. I mean, we swap. I'm booked at the Winter Carnival of Magic, and I'm going to go down there and I'm going to share my secrets. But also, people are going to share their secrets with me. I mean, like that's just like the name of the game. And magicians have swapped books and VHS tapes and DVDs for years. I mean, like. That's a very small part of it. I think the people who are like buying, pirated materials, like they don't understand how badly they're hurting themselves and creators in the industry. And that's just kind of, it's just a bad idea to engage with those people, but it'll get figured out. I mean, is it hurting smaller companies? Yes. Is it hurting bigger companies? Yes. Is it hurting a lot of people? Yes. Is it going to get figured out eventually? Probably. This kind of,
I think most of those people that will buy from sites like that, first of all, like you said, they're just buying it to find out the secret. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, those people are not going to go away, especially in what we do. They're always going to be here.
Ultimately, though, it doesn't matter. I mean, like the people that I perform for, the people that I do magic for, like no one, like the secrecy portion of it to me is so stupid because it's just like, because I was in I was in Apalachicola, Florida last week, and I was with my family, and we're all like triple vaxxed and wearing face masks and stuff. And I'm screwing around with a deck of cards and someone goes, oh, are you playing poker or something, or are you playing gin or whatever? I can't remember what they asked me, but I was like, no, I'm a magician. They're like, oh, would you show me something? And I did a trick that I have had on the market for 4 years now. And the person was blown away. It's like the number of people who are actually like buying secrets and like looking them up on YouTube is so infinitesimally small. I mean, if we Google searched how, like, you know, Penn and Teller Fool Us Revealed, and looked at totaled up all of the views from all of them. And let's say that those weren't even rewatches, right? Let's say they were all discrete people. What's it going to be? You know, a couple million, 10 million, yeah. 100 million. There's 7 billion people in the world. Like, you're going to be fine.
I've never been, I don't want to say I've never been afraid of, oh, they're going to find out my secrets. I'm definitely not now. But I do find things I don't even know if I have an opinion yet, because like I said, the world as a whole is experiencing something that we've never seen before. And so it is interesting a little bit. But I think in the long run, magic will be okay. I do think we'll be okay.
Yeah, I think the people who are really worried about it are often people who don't actually perform in real shows. Exactly. And it's just like, I don't want to demean anyone in the magic world, a hobbyist or performer apart. But like a lot, oftentimes the people who are the most worried about it are either people who don't perform anymore or who have not performed like really seriously, like making their living. Because I can't tell you how many times I do a show where I kill on the show, but there's always a dude like whispering to his girlfriend, like, oh, I don't know how he did that or something like that. Yeah. And it's like, first of all, no, he doesn't, right? There's an antagonistic relationship between me and that dude because he thinks that I want to sleep with his girlfriend, and he wants to feel like the alpha in the situation. Yeah. And that is just like, that there, A, like there's a problem there because I have set up this antagonistic relationship and he feels like he needs to do that, or he's got deep seated, you know, like identity issues, you know, where he's like insecure and there's nothing I can do to stop that. You know, I'm not going to go too deep into this, but I'll just give you a brief example of a time where it was honestly like one of the best shows that I've ever done, because I got booked to perform at a lifestyle club. Let's say it was a swingers club. And oh, if you're yeah. unfamiliar with, if you're unfamiliar with the, you know, the, it was an amazing event, because what these places are, it's a private club where people go to have sex with strangers. And I'm not judging people. You do what you do, live with your life. You know, as long as everyone's safe and consenting, you know, have fun, go
see magic too, apparently. So yeah.
But what would happen is in this club was they would walk in and they would turn to the right and the place is BYOB, because apparently when you run a swingers club, you can't sell liquor. So they sold mixers, which I thought was interesting, just as an interesting legal loophole. But you would have to check your liquor at this front bar. And then I was immediately to the left, and I would just, they had me set up on this like fake, you know, poker, you know, roulette table. There's like a roulette wheel over here, but also there was like a blackjack. It didn't make any sense. And I would just stand there and people would walk in and be like, oh, what are you doing here? And I would be like, I'm a magician. Would you like to see magic? And they would go, sure. And I would do some magic and they're like, wow, that's cool. And then there was a door to the left of me and they would go through that door. And then there was just like, you know, all kinds of like rooms and beds and mattresses, and they would go find strangers to have sex with. And then they would come in, they would check their liquor. They would come see me, see magic trick. They would go off. They would, you know, get the rocks off. And then they would go back to the door to get a drink. And then would come back and go, you know, let me see another magic trick. And I would go, okay. And then they would go back in the other room and they would have sex with a stranger and they come back and they would just do this rotation like all night. And it was just really interesting because at no point did anyone ever say like, oh, I know how you did that, or like grab my hand to see if I was palming something. They were just like, oh, because it was the most secure group of people in the world, because like they were like, everyone is here, just everyone, cards were straight out on the table for everybody. There was no, you know, secrets or like, you know, status symbols or anything like that. I mean, sure there are in that world, but like it wasn't with me, because there's like different agendas and stuff. And there wasn't any sort of like, you know, oh, you know, I gotta be the alpha over this dude. I mean, dudes were like bringing girls over to me like, you gotta check this out, this is amazing. And then they would just go off and plow each other. It was incredible. But like the best quote I've ever gotten from someone was at that event, and I can't use it on my website, but this guy, I finished doing a magic trick and this guy yells across the bar, honey, quit blowing that guy and come watch him. He's amazing. Like that is spectacular quote. Like a guy was, I mean, he wasn't even like, there was none of this, like, my wife is having sex with another man, I've got to stop that. It was like, can you please pause and look at this and then go back to that? I mean, it was insane. It was so good.
Okay, Eric, okay. First of all, man, can you not put that in a quote of your next product that comes out? Come on, man.
No, because I work for
that trick, bro.
Because I work for a family friendly company, and I work for big, you know, big corporations. You know, I mean, but the point of that story was just that, like, if you're in a situation where there's no egos, like it doesn't matter like what's going on. Like what ultimately matters is that like, I'm interesting, engaging, and entertaining, and all of the secrets are out there, and none of those people care, because ultimately all they want to do is just be entertained, and so do good tricks, and it really doesn't matter if they're like, if they know how the secret works. I mean, I'll give you a very good example, also of just like, you know, the Magic Castle, the Mystique Dining Lounge, the Chicago Magic Lounge, all these like magic centric venues, people go there over and over and over again, whether or not, you know, they know how the trick works. And even if the magicians are doing the same tricks week after week after week, I mean, like, you know, how many times do people go to the restaurant and ask for the magician to come to their table, even though that magician hasn't had a new trick in their repertoire in 3 years? Like, it's not about the magic. It never is about the magic. It's about being interesting, engaging, and entertaining. And you do the same stuff year after year and the same tricks, and it's fine, right? I mean, it's just like, it has nothing to do with the miracle that you're
doing. You know, as a magician, when I watch another magic act, you don't have to fool me for me to enjoy your act. If it's entertaining, I'm going to love you a lot more than the guy who... may have done something insane, you know, that I'm like, wow, I have no clue how he did that.
There would be no gala show at any Magic convention if it was about being fooled.
That's true. That's true.
I mean, I'm being fooled is important. I'm not saying it's important. It's just, it's in second place, and it's always going to be in second place. And it's for the show element of it. Right. And it's people, anybody who is ultimately too concerned about this, it's not just that these people haven't performed or don't perform. It's that they're trying to break down Magic and say that this is the most important thing. Ultimately, for me, being fooled is secondary. Entertaining people is the most important thing. Now, do I want to fool them? Absolutely. Do I want to do cool sleights and you know, use a pure deck and only be sleight of hand and not use gas? Yeah, because I like that fulfills me as an artist. But for the people you're performing for, that doesn't matter. That doesn't mean that that is the only thing in Magic, because there are people who it can be only about fooling them. And that's fine, because Magic is a beautiful, multifaceted thing, and everyone can come to it in their own way and be into it for different things. You know, these secret collectors are fine. Just because they're doing it in an unethical way, doing it in an unethical way is awful. Like, they shouldn't do that. But you can be a secret collector. There are tons of people who are secret
collectors. Absolutely.
There's a great documentary right now on HBO called Beanie Mania, and it documents the Beanie Baby craze, like from the inception of the toys, Beanie Babies, to the height of it, when like people were stealing semi-trucks full of this stuff to resell on eBay because they were collecting thousands of dollars off of the toys, to the eventual bottom of the market falling out, and now people collecting Beanie Babies again. And one of the cool things towards the end of the documentary is this... father and daughter, they're both adults, and they've got 22,000 Beanie Babies, and they started collecting at the end of the craze, when people who had spent hundreds of thousands of dollars collecting every Beanie Baby in existence, like, you know, realized that this was no longer an investment and were selling their Beanie Babies for tremendous losses. And they were, and this husband, or this father and daughter, not husband and wife, father and daughter are just like, I like the Beanie Babies. I collect them because they have warm feelings towards these characters. I have no intention of selling these things. Like, that's the same thing. And that's fine. You just, like, the problem becomes when people try and control other people's relationship with something that they like. And sure. That is what I have an issue with. I'm fine with you being a secret collector. I don't like you doing it the way you do. I'm fine with you wanting it to be this crazy art form that only you are involved with. That's fine. Don't put that on me. Engaging with Magic in the way that I do ultimately has absolutely nothing to do with the way you do. And that comes back to everything, you know, like the people who say, like, it's not real Magic if it's a trick that's only for Instagram. Like, fuck you, dude. Like, you're trying to control someone else's relationship with Magic. Ultimately, that's gatekeeping, and gatekeeping is for assholes. So there we go. End of rant.
All right, well, let's do this. Okay. I'm on board with you on that. You know, I there's nothing wrong with people who just want the secrets. It's how you do it, you know.
Yeah.
Support Magic. You know, you
should any way you want.
Yeah. First of all, I want to back up to the swingers party. I actually did a swingers gig one time, but I had no clue it was one, and they were all like senior citizens, which was really interesting. But a great group.
And I also was not sure. I didn't know what it was. Like, the guy called me and was like, we're a lifestyle club. Have you ever been to one of those? And I was like, yeah, sure. They're great. I go all the time because I just wanted the money. And then I show up and I was like, oh, this is what he means. They were a really great group of people. Really nice people.
Great group of people. And it's awesome how the less ego in the audience, the better the audience. And yes, dude, we've all been there. We've been on stage, we've been doing a show, and you run into that guy who needs to look macho in front of his lady. And you know that, I don't know why Magic especially attacks.
It happens with comedians. I mean, I think the only time
comedy too.
I think the only performances where it like doesn't happen is where going to the performance is very passive experience. So like a play or a music. So like, I mean, like you don't see somebody like like at a rock show being like, you know, he's just like pressing down against a piece of wood. And I think that's just because like engaging with comedy or magic or any sort of like performance where there's no fourth wall is a more passive experience, you know, and not that there's a fourth wall in music. It's just that experiencing a concert is more akin to experiencing a play than it is like, you know, someone monologuing or, you know, projecting at you, if that makes sense.
Yeah. You know, it is now, and I think you run into like, you know, with the different styles of magic, like primarily, you know, I do mostly comedy clubs. So I'm on stage most of the time doing my magic, but I have taken, especially this past year, I've taken some more strolling type gigs, some close-up gigs, and it's a different situation with strolling and close-up because each group of person is a new show. You're starting completely over. You're trying to win that audience over. And a few months ago, I ran into a situation to where this guy, bless his heart, man, he had dug himself in the biggest hole, Captain Ego. He knew how the card trick worked. I let him shuffle. And then I, of course, part of the whole thing was the magician in trouble. Oh, I've screwed up. I can't find your card. And he got so much joy. The joy in this guy's face, Eric, when he thought that I actually screwed up. Mm-hmm. I mean, he laughed and everyone at the bar is looking at him and he's like, I switched the bottom card, you know, and he's just all this joy. And inside the back of my mind, I started to feel bad for him because I knew how hard this was going to sting. This was going to hit hard, you know. But then I thought, you know, man, fuck him. So, and then I do the, you know, pull it out of the wallet. It was just a card to wallet is all I was doing. And the look on this guy's face just, and we went from pure joy to, you could tell he didn't know what planet he was on anymore.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to lie. Of course, there was a part of me inside that loved every minute of that. But at the same time, I was like, gosh, it sucks that we doing, especially strolling. You get this more in strolling than anything because I think people are more willing to be an asshole in some of those situations. And it was sad because it's in front of his wife and his daughters and everybody was there. And I was like, God, you look like a total buffoon in front of all those people. And it really bothered me for when I thought about it, for making a guy look like that big of an ass. And don't get me wrong, brother. I'm not one of these people that I can deal with that stuff all day long. Got plenty of practice. But then I got to thinking, I was like, you know what? That guy's probably an asshole at home too. You know what I mean? So, but isn't that interesting? Like how, like when you do strolling, like a lot of people will start out in magic doing strolling and close up first before they make it to the stage. But that doesn't necessarily mean that strolling is any easier than on the stage or close-up magic. You know, I think they both have their own difficulties. And there's a part of strolling, to be honest with you, that is absolutely tougher.
Yeah, I think that, like, I mean, ultimately, all, like, it's very difficult to do a good show. And I'm definitely better in close up and strolling than I am on stage, and I've made a concerted effort to get better and being on stage. I've done a lot more clubs and stage shows in the last few years, and I've like worked really hard to get to the show to the point where I like it, because I used to like do these, you know, things, but I didn't like my show. I actually kind of like what I'm doing now. Like, it's fun for me. My friend Curtis Hendricks says that I play with really like surrealism in magic on stage, like, you know, surrealism and absurdity. She says that I do that really well. And I think that maybe it's just cause I'm attracted to that kind of comedy. And you know, people are more willing to pay attention to me if I'm doing magic when I'm doing that kind of stuff. you know, I do the card duck, but it like smokes and has prison tattoos and stuff like that.
Nice.
It's weird. But I think that being a good strolling magician is very difficult. And I think that a lot of people have confused effort with achievement. I'm sounding like my dad. I think that there are very few people who are truly good at strolling and close-up magic. I think that they've just like done it a lot because it is, it's easier to get a bar or a restaurant to allow you to walk around once or twice and do a couple of tricks for people than it is to get a big theater to take a risk on putting your name on the marquee and, you know, hiring, you know, someone to run lights and sound and ticket booth and, you know, get people in that venue to see you. Like it's a lot easier to it's a much lower risk reward scenario when people are just like already going to come for the food than the drinks. You know, I mean, like I can't think of a lot of restaurants that I've been to where they have like a working magician where people are just like, we go to this place for the magician, not the food. Like that's just, it's just a very different, it's a very different experience. And I am very fortunate that I am now at a point in my career where people will go places to see me. And I've worked very hard to get there. And so it's, they're both difficult. It just depends, I guess. I don't really know the question was aimed at, but,
well, no. And yeah. I should have been more clear, man. Sorry about that. The, you know, primarily, like I said, I had been on stage, especially before the pandemic, that's, you know, mostly, and then you start to build this, I guess, opinion that, you know, well, you know, what I'm doing is tougher than just walking around and showing tricks. And
yeah,
this past year actually was, you know, kind of like opened my eyes. I was like, well, you know, they're both very difficult in their own ways. And there's other obstacles that you have to get over when doing strolling that you don't have to do on the stage.
Yeah. I think that like ultimately it's all different kinds of performance and it's all different venues. You know, you see a lot of like stage magicians have a really difficult time going back to doing close-up or strolling because it's like the venues have different rules. And you see a lot of like close-up magicians having a hard time like getting to the stage just because like they don't understand that like you can't see this from the back of a 500 seat theater. You know, like they think like, oh, this is big enough that I can see it like, you know, 20 feet away. And it's like, well, actually you have to think about it. Like, yes, not only are they 20 feet away, but also the room is dark. The lights are bright. You're moving it around. You know, there's details to be involved. Some, you know, if someone's wearing glasses, this is going to be tough. So it's like, that's why you see a lot more like mentalists on stage and like mentalism in these big stage shows is because like, it's all like, you know, you just say something and like, that's the effect. You know, like reading a mind is a lot easier to like make an entire room full of people understand what happened rather than like bringing a card to the top of the deck. You know, like I have a routine I do in my stage show, Card to Pocket, and it's kind of a weird routine because I have to make it play so big. And in like, even in a comedy club, you know, I'm still working on it. But it was built for a room. It was the routine was built for the Mystique Dining Lounge in Salt Lake City, Utah. Cause that's a strange venue to play. You know, there are people right at your elbows because you're performing at the head of a table, but there's still people who are like 20, 30 feet away. So they have to be able to see it. They have to be able to understand what's going on. But it's just learning the different rules for the venues, and each venue is going to have its own, you know, people who are interested in watching you and people who aren't. And so it's all about learning those rules, I think.
There you go. Definitely. I agree with you 100%. Let's do this, Eric Tate.
Sure.
On the Abracadam podcast, we ask every entertainer to tell a Hail Gig story. You, sir, let's hear one.
So just sort of like, you know, there's always like little like things that pop out. You know, we're talking about like people who are like smart alecks and stuff like that. There's like, I vividly remember this dude, once. I was doing, I've got a routine I do. It's a full deck Olin water routine. And, you know, for the non-magicians, it's basically like the deck is thoroughly shuffled. And then when you spread it out, the cards immediately separate so that they're separated into reds and blacks, red cards on one side and black cards on the other. And I remember this dude at a strolling gig. I was working for this big company and he was kind of drunk, but he also like loudly said like, look, the magician won't let the engines and he said the N word with a hard R on it.
Oh my God.
Mix. Like not that engines is, you know, it's also a racial slur. You know, he was very comfortable saying two racial slurs really close to one another. And he thought that was the funniest thing in the world. And no one said anything to him. And I saw him there again, like a couple of years later. So it was just like, oh, these like, and I remember just having to think like, oh, I gotta let this go. Cause I know that like, I'm getting paid to be here for 2 hours more than this guy probably makes in a month. So I've just like, don't just like be whatever, but like, that's not like a gig story. That's just like, oh man, this was super uncomfortable.
That's always the worst too. Whenever, you know, someone comes up or they want, you know, a lot of times, cause you do comedy too. So I know you've had this probably happen to you where,
yeah,
you know, afterwards, after a show, somebody will come up to me and they want to tell me a joke, you know, and it'll go into being some racist and you're like, oh God, please. No. Just stop.
Or it's just like, stop. Yeah. Or I mean, even like the magic industry, like I've been at conventions and people have like told me like, you know, pretty homophobic jokes and they're like, they don't know anything about me at all. And I'm just like, this is really uncomfortable right now for you and you don't understand why. But I think that like probably when I get asked like this kind of a question, the story that comes to mind was when I was in college. So I went to a place called Humber College and I have a degree in comedy writing and performance. And one of the things that the school would do was they would sort of identify like what area of comedy the students were like most focused in. Cause people would call the program up all the time and be like, hey, can we get some of your comedy students to come out and do a show for us? And, you know, and it was like this. So like the college like acted like a little bit of a booking agency for us, which the program did, not the college, which was like kind of cool. And I was big into stand-up at the time. And, they picked me for whatever reason. They were like, here's the venue, like go do this. And I was like sick. And so I get there and this is sort of the time before, this is a time before smartphones are out. So like I had to use MapQuest directions to get to a venue via public transit. Cause also it's in Toronto. So like, it's just like, it's really common in Toronto for no one to have a car. Cause it's a little bit like New York. Public transit's great. Traffic is terrible. So, excuse me. So I get the venue and it's a big library and I'm like, cool. It's got like a theater or whatever. And so I get there and they explain to me that what the gig is it is a, there's a, this part of Toronto had an after school program where the kids would come together and work on creative projects. And they likened it to the late night basketball program in New York City. If you had kids playing basketball after school and at night, then they wouldn't be like running around like breaking windows and doing drugs and stuff. And the end of the program, or like periodically in the program, they would do this like talent show, and it was also like a talent contest. And so the kids would like work on their talent, whatever it was, and then they would come out and perform, and then like they would judge it, and then the kids would like win a prize or whatever. And also this is very specifically for like low income kids, you know, kids who parents don't make a lot of money or are in and out of jail. And so what they wanted to do was give the kids like a role model to look up to. And so they would get a professional entertainer to come in and headline it. And they would, you know, give them a couple of bucks or whatever as a thank you. But mostly it was like a, you know, do this out of the goodness of your heart thing. And then the kids could see what a professional entertainer looked like. And I guess they'd had like, you know, some other jugglers, magicians and stuff like that, but I'm doing stand-up at the time. And I don't really know what the gig is until I get there. I just know that I'm supposed to go do stand-up, you know, which is like, this is all like, you know, my inexperience. I should have asked a lot more questions. I should have like, hey, you guys need to get me information. And what's really important to understand at this time is that I'm not doing a lot of magic. Like I'm still doing magic, but like I'm mostly a hobbyist at this point because I'm very focused on stand-up. And you should also understand that I am a 20-year-old political comedian at the height of the Bush administration. So like, and I thought I was going to be the next Lewis Black, you know, and I was pretty good. I got on XM radio and was like doing some good stuff, but like a 20-year-old American political comedian in the height of the Bush administration in Canada, is like not what these people were looking for. So, cause like that, you know, like, there's these kids going out and like doing dances and, you know, singing songs and like doing, it'll be just like, you know, it's a kid's talent show. I mean, and these kids are like 9 to 15. So it's like, they're young and they go, you know, and then they're like, the show is coming to an end. And then they go to, they kind of be like, hey, we gotta do the judging. So will you, so your time is up. So you go out and do 15 minutes. And I'm like, okay. And I have like 5 good minutes at the time, but I just like, I walk out and I'm going to do 15 minutes of political comedy to parents watching their children do dances and sing songs. And, you know, and I'm like angry because Lewis Black is my hero. I died a horrible death. But the one thing that had always been impressed on me by the school was just like, you always do your time. You get to the end of, you don't go short. You don't go long. You do your time. They book you for 15 minutes. You do 15 minutes. So I do my 15 minutes and again, I've only got like 5 good minutes at the time. So, so it's 5 great minutes and then 10 mediocre minutes. And I leave to crickets. And then they come back out and they go, it was Eric Tate, ladies and gentlemen. And it's just like nothing, just dead. And then they go, well, we have to tabulate the scores. And while we do that, let's hear some more comedy from Eric Tate. And they introduce me again. And they just like sort of push me back out there. And I do crowd work to people who hate me. So they just like give me nothing. And it's just like, and they like didn't give me time, like an amount of time either. I mean, like, and like now I'm skilled enough to like know what I'm doing. So like just like right before the pandemic, I hosted this cosplay event at a big sort of like Comic-Con anime convention type deal. The judges at this thing were like supposed to tabulate things on like a custom iPad app that kept crashing. So they were like, can you fill? So I just like, you know, and I'm like a nerd. So I'm like riffing on Zelda, Magic the Gathering, Pokemon, like whatever, like costumes that people have. I'm skilled enough now to do that. At the time, I should remind you, I'm a 20-year-old political comedian in front of parents who hate me. It's like the crowd work is just not doing well. And then, they come back out and they like announce the winner and then everyone leaves. And then I have to like go wait by a bus stop, to like that, like other people who were there are like going to get on the bus with me. There's like no one's talking to me. And then the host of the show walks over, to the bus stop and goes, hey man, like I thought you were great. And he introduces himself and I wish I could remember his name, but I can't, but he's the weather reporter on like the local news, who is like very involved in the program to like, you know, keep kids out of gangs and off drugs and stuff like that. So he's just like real appreciative that I came out at all. And he goes, hey, where do you live? And I go, oh, I live in Humber College on the Lakeshore campus. And he goes, oh, you know, I'm headed that way. Can I give you a ride? And I was just like, you know what? Don't say yes. Don't say no. Just get in the truck and make your peace with God. So I get in this dude's pickup truck and he's heading back and he goes, hey, have you eaten yet? And I was like, no. And he goes, well, I'm supposed to go interview someone actually at the restaurant across the street from the campus. Let me buy you dinner. And I was like, oh, that's fine. And we get there and he goes, hey, just so you know, like these guys might be a little rough around the edges, but just be cool. You'll be fine. And I was like, oh, okay. And so we go into this restaurant that is a hole. It is a dive bar that is across. I don't know if it's still there, but it was like, it was the kind of place where you would like bring your own mug. Cause the ones there are like real dirty. We sit down and they're like, who is this guy? And there's like some pretty rough looking dudes. And he's like, oh, his name's Eric. He's a comedian and magician. We just did a show together. Eric, show him a couple of tricks. And I was like, oh, okay. So I show him some card tricks and like, oh, that was nice. And then they proceed to talk, and it is an interview because he's not just the local weather reporter. He's also the local crime reporter. And it's an interview with the leader of the Hells Angels in Toronto. Oh. Yeah. And so he's like talking to him about like just all kinds of crazy stuff that had happened like with the Hells Angels. And they're like, no, we're a motorcycle club or whatever. But like everyone in the room like knew like we're not a motorcycle club. Like we're the traffickers of meth and weapons in Canada. And he's just like, he's asking stories about this like big bust that had happened recently and like trying to get stuff. And I was just like, I just had to like sit there and like, just, you know, like I had a deck of cards on me. And so I'm just like shuffling cards and like doing whatever. But like, yeah, so it went from dying a horrible death, like doing terrible political comedy to people who hated me to then getting pushed back out on stage to getting a ride home and then surprise dinner with the leader of the Hells Angels in Canada, who then like, I leave and it's not like I'm going to go across town. Like I go across the street. They like know where I live now. So that was just like, yeah. So that was pretty awful.
That is an awesome story though. A pretty cool ending there.
Yeah, I'm still like, I'm to this day not sure why he thought it was like okay to bring me to dinner with this guy, like on an interview. Like I still like don't understand the thought process to be like hey, like I mean, like weather reporters are weird anyway. But so like I don't know, like it was really strange. I just like it was the whole experience was like really messed up.
Okay, well let's do this.
Okay.
Let's get into a thought-provoking question here, Eric Tate.
Okay.
On the Abracadabra podcast, we ask every magician this question. All right?
All right.
So let's say that you wake up and you realize you are stranded on a desert island.
Okay.
You have 1,000 spears pointed at your neck by the indigenous people on this island.
Okay.
They don't like you. Okay?
Okay.
You, as a magician,
yeah,
have the choice of one magic trick to show these people to try to convince them that you are a god. What magic trick do you do?
It is a flawed question because you're basically talking about the Robert Houdin. Like, what is my Robert Houdin? What is my light and heavy chest to stop a war in India?
Absolutely, Eric, but keep in mind we got regular people listening, so
yeah. I mean the answer is I die. There's just like I don't do a trick. Like if there's 1,000 spears pointed at me and they don't like me, presumably I have already tried to do a magic trick for them, and that is why the spears are pointed at me. And like it's really gross of me to try and get them to convince them that I'm a god, like to try and C-3PO these people. Whatever I already did not go well. And that is why I'm in this position. And so my magic trick is hopefully to gain the powers of Jesus Christ and come back from the dead after they brutally murder me. That's the answer is I do nothing. I reflect on my life choices that got me here into this horrible, horrible situation. I cry and shit my pants. That is what I do.
Well, okay, let's just say maybe you survive this and you pull a Jesus Christ moment. There we go. Mm-hmm. Okay, all right. And then they love you.
I think that in any scenario, there's no way that I come out of this where anybody likes me.
Well, man, Eric, dude, this has been fun, brother. I tell you what, before we get out of here, mm-hmm. Where can the listeners learn more about Eric Tate?
You can always go to penguinmagic.com. I am featured on there pretty frequently, and I host our Penguin Live lectures. So if you are a magician, you can come see me, talk to and help learn some of the greatest secrets from the best magicians in the world. Also, there's some pretty cool tricks on there that you can learn. People can follow me if they go to my website, erictate.com. There's a whole bunch of stuff there. I'm on Twitch, twitch.tv/suspicious wizard. The first I is a one because there's already somebody squatting on the real tag suspicious wizard. I don't stream very much, but when I do stream, it's usually me building Legos and talking to people. But if you can't remember how that and you're like, I can't figure this, you just go to historicalporpoises.com. Like, you know, like history dolphins, historicalporpoises.com. And that just leads me to wherever I'm currently doing stuff. You can look me up on Facebook. But if you search for Suspicious Wizard or Delusion Masters, also I'm on Instagram. So those are at Eric Tate. Those are all the different places. And if you search, if you look up Ships of the Northern Fleet, I come up pretty frequently in there. You can find out more about me when you're looking up stuff about Ships of the Northern Fleet. So that's all the stuff. Oh, and listen to the Penguin Magic podcast. I interview the most famous magicians in the world about all kinds of cool stuff.
Fantastic. Eric, dude, this has been a blast, brother. Thank you so much for coming on.
Sure thing. Thank you.
All right. I hope you guys enjoyed that conversation there with Eric Tate. Definitely an interesting dude. And I want to wish him the best of luck at FISM. If you guys have not done so yet, be sure to subscribe and follow the Abracadam podcast. We are literally everywhere. We're on every platform you can imagine, so we're easy to find. So be sure to follow and subscribe to the podcast. We got some amazing guests coming up, some super exciting guests that I can't say anything about, but I really want to, but I'm super excited. Anyways, definitely give us a follow, and I guess that's it. So, like always, Abracadamits, thank you for listening. Awesome. Abracadamits.
Will you please stop drinking vodka at my kid's birthday party?